And welcome to the second day meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee 69 public meeting. The time is 1:05. We are looking forward to a very informative presentation by a representative of PG&E. Let me address the first item on the agenda, which will be committee members' comments. Dr. Butness and Dr. Peterson, please. Absent any comment, let's go to the second
item.
Yeah,
I just have one for 5 seconds. We had a public tour this morning. We have it every time. And those of you that might be... Those of you that might be looking remotely ought to know that we have it, and you can sign up and come. It's always very interesting for us and for the public.
Thank you, Dr. Bennis. The second item on our agenda would be public comments on items that are not on the committee's public meeting agenda, which means any item the member of the public would wish to address, please come forward to the podium and identify yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Henriette Groot. I am a member of Mothers for Peace. I have this to say to you, or I should mention I also have a statement to present to you from Jane Swanson, but let me first wear my own hat. I'm asking, actually begging you, to concern yourself with the question of what is the future for nuclear waste. I took a look at your history website and the last annual report. The annual report appeared very well done, comprehensive. It was, however, somewhat lacking in concern for the future, but perhaps that was in the part that I did not have time to read. Well, I read more and I still found very little along those lines. The part I read was mainly responding to what happened in the past, and I was doing that very well. Future projections. The video about the IFCCs mentioned that there was space for all the waste fuel till 2015. The annual report from you stated that both the pool and the ISFC would be full in 60 years. It occurs to me that you are in a unique position to get the ball rolling on the distant future. You are the most educated, most knowledgeable, have served a number of terms. You are in a position to ask questions of the part of all the parties, the NRC, PG&E, PUC, and who all else. You are also independent. The problem, namely, is what is the future for storage of the waste? Your may be out, probably is out, although there's some doubt about that, into nuclear storage site right here. The community has a right to know that, to have a say in that, and to say how it should be done. There are many questions about SVC safety. How long are they safe for? A 20-year warranty extended to 40 years? Then what? Or maybe these numbers, I didn't get them quite right. Someone has to do long-term planning. Do you realize we need for you to be immortal for at least hundreds of thousands of years? That's how long we will actually need a Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. Please put this on your agenda and get the discussion started. The people of this county who were responsible for the startup of this committee would be very grateful. Okay, that's my statement. And here's the one from Jane Swanson. She says, with apologies that I am unable to be present at public comment time at today's meeting, I have asked Mothers for Peace member Henriette Groot to read into the record the following comments in support of the questions and comments she is planning to make on the topic of the storage of radioactive waste. I look forward to hearing your replies when I view the video recording of this meeting on your website in time. she requests of the DCIC, ask PG&E about its plans for moving spent fuel rods out of the densely packed spent fuel pools and into the more protective dry casks. My understanding is that PG&E is moving fuel into the cask only for the purpose of making space in the pools for removal of rods during refueling outages. Given that the dry casks are much safer than spent fuel pools, as shown at Fukushima, why is PG&E not moving the fuel into the casks at an accelerated rate for safety purposes? And the next heading is questions of the DCIC. I understand the mandate of the DCIC to include shining the spotlight on issues pertaining to public safety. Does this include the question of whether the public is safer with hardened on-site storage of radioactive waste or with transporting waste on our highways and railways? SLOW, Mothers for Peace, advocates strongly for HOSS, that's a hardened on-site storage, but would be interested in any additional information DCIC or PG&E would shed on the topic. Can a member of the committee update us on the transportation options under consideration should the NRC ever implement interim waste storage? My understanding is that the Department of Energy would have responsibility in overseeing transportation and that it has abandoned its former option.
Then it'd be easy for us to enter them into the record, if that's possible.
Yeah, I think I can.
Okay,
take
great.
You
okay.
Great. Any other public members who would like to address the committee, please come to the podium. And please identify yourself.
I am Sherry Lewis from San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, and I just want to reiterate based on the article that I read into the record yesterday and left with you on your table from Klaus Schumann and Fred Frank dealing with the waste storage in the pools. And that is a present matter. That's not off into the future. Is that something that you are able to deal with about getting it reduced? Do you know what I'm saying? Fewer rods in the pools is what I'm after. Get the extra rods put into hardened cask storage. That's what I'm asking you to look into, please. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for your comments.
Let's see if there's any other comments.
Right. Let us entertain additional public comments before any responses will be provided. Any additional public comments? Please come to the podium at this time. Hearing none, any one of us are prepared to address the comments from Dr. Good and from Ms. Lewis?
Maybe I should... make a couple of statements related to the nuclear waste problem. The federal government has the responsibility to remove spent fuel from reactor sites and to manage it safely and ultimately place it into disposal in geologic repository. The federal government has not upheld those responsibilities. The linkage is through contracts with utilities, and those contracts are legally binding on the federal government. And so the added cost associated with the on-site storage is being returned back to utilities and to ratepayers through judgments paid through the judgment fund by taxpayers. And, of course, taxpayers and ratepayers generally are similar people, but there has been a substantial failure in our country's policies for developing and managing spent fuel and its ultimate disposal. And other countries have been much more successful. Finland and Sweden, for example, have. China is actually at this point cited and moving forward with a very comprehensive system of repositories, reprocessing both deep and intermediate level waste disposal in the Gobi Desert. They have locations that are both geologically stable, quite suitable for this purpose. Annual rainfall is negative because there's more evaporation than rainfall. And the nearest families to the sites they're looking at are over 300 kilometers away. But in the United States, we've faced some significant changes. Independent Safety Committee, really, our charter doesn't extend to the question of the safety of the waste disposal, but I think it does encompass the interim storage on the site and the possibility that that interim storage could be extended in time much longer than would be desirable. And so we review periodically the independent storage facility, and I think it's probably something that would be good for us to put back up on our agenda to check on what the status is in upcoming fact-finding meetings.
And if I may add a comment to respond to Ms. Lewis' article, I am sure, Ms. Lewis, you are well aware the California Energy Commission has sent ongoing and outstanding recommendation for Diablo Canyon to restore the spent fuel pool density to its original configuration. So that issue, it's ongoing and has been examined in detail by the Energy Commission and by Diablo Canyon. Now, there are both technical and policy barriers to accelerating of that process. One of the technical barriers is that the dry cask cannot accommodate 100% of its inventory if they are younger than 5 years for the spent fuel. So you need to pick and choose what goes into that cask. And furthermore, there are regulatory limits as to how many casks right now has been licensed. So there are some of the consideration that's being examined now. And I certainly, for one, appreciate this article. I think it is timely, it's relevant, and it's material in some of the things that we are considering. And thank you. All right, without additional public comments, now I'd like to introduce Mr. Kerry Harbour, who is the Director of Compliance and Risk from PG&E, and Mr. Harbour would be the coordinator for the PG&E presentation for today.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So our first speaker for today is Mike Wright. He is our Manager of Engineering. Mike will be talking to us about our control room ventilation system and providing an update to the panel on that. Mike has 25 years of experience in the nuclear industry. He has a Bachelor of Science degree in nuclear engineering. He's held leadership roles in maintenance, operations, and engineering.
Welcome, Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks, Kerry.
Welcome.
Thank you. All right. Again, my name is Mike Wright, Mechanical Systems Engineering Manager at Diablo Canyon. Here today to talk about the control room ventilation system. Today we're going to talk about some of the challenges we faced in the past 2 years with the control room ventilation systems in the area of testing, in the area of design vulnerability, and the solutions we put in place to resolve those testing and design vulnerability issues, and then our long-term actions that we have in place. In simplified view, train one for unit one, train two on unit two, cross-tie capability, we'll check out this mouse, between the two, and that will play a role in some discussion I have a little bit later, so remember that any units trained can feed the other units' trains. and again, there are two sub-trains within each train. Next slide, please. So there are four operating modes for the control room vent system. The first is mode one. That's the normal mode of operation where the system's in about 95% of the time. In that mode, and I'll use the pictorial here, it's try to make it kind of simple enough to understand, but complicated enough to provide some information. The control room is depicted on the right here with the tall rectangle. In mode one, about the air that's exhausted from the control room, about 73% of that air is recirculated, conditioned, and brought back into the control room. 27% of the air is exhausted to the outside, and of course 27% of the air is supplied from the outside to the control room. And that's mode one ventilation. Before we go to the next slide, I will make note that new backdraft damper in this location. Again, this is part of the exhaust line that comes from the control room. Part of it's recirculated through to conditioning. Part of it is recirculated through in a later mode to run through a high-energy, high-efficient particulate absorber or HEPA filter, charcoal filter, and roughing filter. And this line is normally the flow goes up, say, in this line. So we installed it. Later in discussion, I'll explain why we had to install a backdraft damper in this line. More to come on that. Mode 2 is our fire mode, and the purpose of this mode is if the control room is engulfed in smoke or other asphyxiant that you need to exhaust from the control room, the ventilation is such that 100% of the exhaust flow goes out and 100% of the makeup flow is from the outside. So it's basically all out, all in mode 2. Next slide, please. Mode 3 is the recirculation mode of operation, where 100% of the air from the control room is cleaned up. In other words, 73% of the air is cleaned up just through conditioning and through normal filters. 27% of the air is cleaned up through the HEPA, charcoal, and roughing filters. Combines back together, it goes back to the control room. So in this mode, there's no outside air coming in from either the normal source or the pressurization system, and there's no air going out through the normal ventilation system. Mode 4 is the last mode of operation. It's similar to mode 3. It may be hard to see on this slide, but the only difference between mode 3 and mode 4 is the left-hand side where it says outside air. This is our pressurization system fans that provide additional makeup to the control room in this mode that help the control room provide a positive pressure with respect to the outside air. So the design basis is we have to provide enough positive pressure such that the control room is at least 1/8 of an inch water above the outside air or the outside environment. In actuality, our system runs for about 1/4 of an inch or about 100% more than the requirements when we're in mode 4. Yes, sir.
Can it actually be adjusted?
Can you adjust it?
How do you do that?
That's a good question. In our part of our design that we put in place in 2012 was to change how we would adjust it. On the left is from our pressurization system. That comes physically. You're at the plant today. So physically, it's located on the turbine building roof. At the far north end of the plant, as you'll see, you can't see unless you're looking for it, there's a suction up there going to the fans associated on the unit one side. On the far south west corner, similarly for the fans associated on unit two. And that's only for the pressurization fans. This outside air port is the for normal makeup air, and it's actually right on the side of the mechanical equipment room, more by the 10% steam dumps or the main steam safety valves. That's in that area. That's the normal outside air supply, and this is only for pressurization fans.
We reviewed the system not too long ago, and I recall there were two outside intakes.
Yes.
Depending on, with radiation detectors on them, to use one or the other. Are these the two? In addition to this?
In this pictorial, I'm showing one unit or one train. So this is one. The other is a mirror image, if I dare use that word. For unit two, it would be down below pictorially on this one. And those would be the two possible sources for a pressurization system. Both of them have rad monitors associated with them, such that if high radiation is detected on one train or subtrain of them, it automatically swaps to the other unit.
Right. And the two physical locations are?
Yes, sir.
What, each end of the turbine building?
Yes, sir. Each end of the turbine building, so the length of the turbine building separated from each other.
Thank you.
Good questions? Any other questions on the four modes of operation? I'll move on. I'm sure you'll ask them as we go. So now that we talked about the operation of the system, I'll describe a little bit of the issues that we had. First, in roughly in 2003, the NRC, get the mouse out of the way, decided through the use of Reg Guide 1.197 and Generic Letter 2003 that the industry could do a better job at testing the strength or the ability of the control room envelope to keep the bad stuff out and the good stuff in. Previous to this, we were using differential pressure tests, and the assumption was that if your control room envelope is at a higher differential pressure, higher pressure than your outside air, all the air is going from outside to in, and things should be good. But what they've found, again, this is in the late 90s and 2003, is that there are other elements that need to be taken into consideration other than just DP that might affect the ability of the control room envelope to be tight. So determined that the industry would change from differential pressure type testing to a tracer gas testing to determine more accurately the leak tightness of your control room envelope. That was in around 2003 time frame, and it requested all licensees to perform this testing within a period of time to verify that the assumed in leakage into the control room is within your general design criteria 19 or GDC 19 dose limits or your assumptions for your operator dose.
What is CRE?
Control room envelope, and apologize for not spelling that out up there. Yes, ma'am. Next slide, please. So it's in the conclusion section here, so if you bear with me for a second. So in 2011, if I could fast forward a little bit, there was a maintenance activity going on the control room vent system supply fan, one of the four supply fans. It was disassembled for repairs, and our senior resident inspector at the time had a good questioning attitude and inquired with engineering if this configuration with the fan out of service and isolated was a tested configuration. So we delved into the 2005 test some more, and in looking at that test, we determined that even though that test was performed in four separate phases, one with each subtrain on each train, so two times two, four separate phases, it was not the most limiting configuration as we would determine today. In addition, we found a second problem with that test that was performed. There were four subtests performed for that overall test. While one of the tests had a zero CFM or cubic feet per minute result, one of the subtests had 59 cubic feet per minute. And we should have reported the higher leakage and used that leakage to confirm that our operator dose limitations are within our design basis, but we did not. So as a result, you know, we received a notice of violation for that. We've since, in 2011, revised our testing methodology so that only one train or one subtrain on one train or one out of the four sets of fans are running and the other three are secured, and then re-performed that test in 2011. And David, did I answer your question? If I didn't, I'll come back to it. Next slide, please. So more on that test. While performing that test with one subtrain only running, we found a design deficiency. And I'm going to actually go one slide ahead so I can talk about it real quick, Pete, then we'll come back. Again, this is a picture of the train that's idle, or the train not in service, and that's why the X's are over the booster fans and the X's are over the supply fans. What we found, again, if you remember earlier, I talked about that cross-tie capability and how to have a role in this. Our system, I should say, all nuclear plants' control room ventilation systems are, they weren't designed by Westinghouse, they're designed by the utilities, okay, or AEs, architect engineers for the utilities. So there's differences among different power plants. Ours is fairly robust in the fact that it has cross-tie capability between units, and it has four subtrains when you need one to operate. One of the challenges that imparted, though, is if you recall that this line is the exhaust line, right, normally going right to the outside air. One of the challenges that the system has with both booster and supply fans secured on that train, we found a path where flow from the pressurization system coming this way would go backwards through the exhaust line, bypassing the charcoal filter, which is our the when I say filtered system, the big picture here is charcoal filter to remove iodine, right? Bypass the charcoal filter and direct it into the control room. About 800 cubic feet per minute of flow was observed going in that direction. And that was, we didn't have as tight of limitations as we would say on emergency core cooling system pumps where there's two and you got to have two all the time, right? We imposed tech spec limitations on our booster and supply fans now such that we could always have one operating. And when one is operating, that reverse flow path through the exhaust system doesn't exist. It goes through preferentially through the filter unit. David.
Maybe I was thinking while you were just talking. Could you shift back to the previous slide?
Next slide, please.
As I understood it, that there was also an impact, maybe this is just what you were saying, again, while I was thinking.
It's okay.
That this potential or actual situation also required the other system to be in recirc mode. That this one was in pressurization mode and the other one was in recirc mode. Now here it doesn't appear that that's,
right.
That's
so
necessary.
This picture is with a one train completely secured.
Oh, the okay.
Right? And then yeah. to remedy the design deficiency that is in place with this flow path, we put in place a compensatory measure such that we would in an accident we would always have one train in mode 4 or pressurization mode, and the other train would be available in mode 3 recirculation mode, like you're saying, with a fan, a booster fan, supply fan in operation, such that flow coming from the outside would always preferentially go through the charcoal filter and not through this exhaust line.
Okay. But the but it doesn't matter. It would still you'd still have a leakage issue if the other one was secured, the other system was just secured, or
again, there's two subtrains on each
yeah.
train.
Okay.
So what we put in place for a compensatory measure were actions to verify that we always had at least one subtrain on both trains always operable to prevent the situation where we wouldn't have the ability of a fan on both trains to operate.
Okay.
So we eliminated this design vulnerability by putting in place measures where equipment would always be available.
Okay.
In parallel to that, we started a design change process to determine a solution for this. Maybe I'll go through that solution
okay.
phase and see if that
okay.
answers your
okay.
next question. Next slide, Pete. Well, before that, the back a slide. I missed a couple bullets on that previous slide. One more. Thank you. That test with the with one train in mode 3 and one train in mode 4, the result of that test was 51 cubic feet per minute of in leakage. And in addition to that amount of in leakage, we found three other sources of potential unfiltered in leakage that were put into our corrective action program and have since been resolved. Two slides forward, please. Now, if I scroll ahead to 2012, in October of 2012, we implemented a design change to install a backdraft damper or check valve in that exhaust line that I referred to earlier to eliminate or the design deficiency that existed. In addition, we corrected the three sources of test. Next slide, please. This slide depicts the design change or the enhancement to eliminate the design vulnerability, and that is with this check valve, and if it were a through check valve, you'd see a little thing here where the flow is this way and not this way. Okay.
Explain to the public how a check valve works.
Okay.
In 20 seconds.
Okay. Check valve allows flow in one direction only. If flow were to try to come the other direction, it closes. It's a passive device.
It's a one-way street.
It's a one-way street.
Your mic's
That's
not
correct.
On, Bob.
Yeah, so just so the public knows, a check valve allows flow one way and blocks it the other way, right?
That is
yeah.
correct.
Yeah.
Next slide, please. So after we implemented the backdraft damper or check valve, we ended up with a control room envelope in leakage test that was valid. Our leakage results, again, were 31 cubic feet per minute. That number was put into an interim dose analysis that we're using to confirm that the operator dose or the dose to the control room operators is within our general design criteria limits and the control room vent system is operable. Now, in the long term, we are going down the path that many other utilities have already taken to adopt a new methodology called an alternate source term methodology to restore some of our control room envelope dose margins. Again, I said many other utilities have done this. The existing methodology is overly conservative with how you have to assume the accident occurs in site containment and how quick that dose is seen at the intake of the control room vent system. The results of that for other plants have resulted in at least 5 to 10 or more times more margin. It's just being more realistic on how the accident would play out. We are, again, going through that methodology right now with some support from a vendor. Plan to turn that into the NRC in 2014. They'll review that, and typically it takes about a year to approve the methodology change so that we can implement in 2015. So, again, what we talked about today was challenges we've had over the past couple of years in the area of testing, in the area of a design vulnerability, the corrections that we've made in the area of testing, found the design problem, fixed the design problem, and are looking to, again, regain margins in the future. Open up for questions. Robert.
Maybe it'll only take a brief moment to explain the alternate source term methodology. The source term is the amount of radioactivity that emerges when an accident's underway.
Yes, sir.
And I understand this. You'll tell me whether I got it right, but I think I do. The previous NRC requirements required you and every plant to assume an unrealistically, what we now understand to be an unrealistically large source term,
yes.
And more realistic analysis based on experiments has been done, and that enables you to do a more realistic calculation of what the actual doses will be.
That's exactly correct.
I mean, I think I just said that in 30 seconds, and just explaining to the public, and thereby we all have a more realistic understanding of not only what the doses would be, but what the demand.
Radioactive iodines.
Or to abandon the control room and go to the alternate panel and control the plant from there, which is, of course, part of the design of every plant.
It is part of the design. Yes, sir.
Right, so there are three means to mitigate that.
You don't want to do that unless it's...
Yeah, from an ex-operator, the last place I want to leave is the control room.
Right. But it's there if you need it.
It's there if you need it, that's correct.
Now, the remote panel, does it do everything you, as a reactor operator, you would know? Does it do everything you want it to do?
The hot shutdown panel has the capability to bring the unit to a mode to hot shutdown, trip the plant, be stable. There are many forms of indication, both at the hot shutdown panel, at the dedicated shutdown panel, which is a different panel in the auxiliary building, and other indications around the plant. It's just more challenging because it's not all together. But we, the operators do, that's more in the more for the area of Appendix Romeo or fire protection or fire issues in the control room or cable spread room. And we have procedures in place, and we do a significant amount of operator training and testing to ensure that we can safely shut down the plant from those panels.
Have you written this up so that all the other plants in the country can learn the lessons of this if others might have the same problem?
Yes, that's we use operating experience through the Institute of Nuclear Power.
Yeah, I knew the answer to that. I was just asking you to say it.
Yes, sir. We have submitted our OE or operating experience from our issues.
I mean, the fact that the public ought to know that when something like this happens anywhere, everybody gets a chance to see whether it'll apply to them.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
The station constantly reviews a significant amount of operating experience daily to determine, one, applicability to our plant, and two, most important, what can we learn from somebody else's challenges.
Yeah, and you've just had this, and others are going to learn from that.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So you roll it up as an OE, operating experience?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And it does not rise to the level of SOER, significant operating experience report?
No, we submit it as OE. The IMPO determines how high it goes, whether it's...
how significant it is.
I see.
Now it's called an IER, or industry event.
But in any event, everybody sees it.
Exactly.
For sure.
Okay.
Mike, you mentioned, or someone mentioned, the alternate shutdown panel. mm-hmm. right, which you would use. What supplies ventilation to that?
We normal, that's located on the 100-foot auxiliary building, so the normal ventilation for the equipment in that area, there's not a special ventilation system for that area. It's the normal...
normal auxiliary building ventilation system?
Yes, correct. Yes.
Okay. And has that been looked at for post-accident livability, so habitability?
It's not required to. Again, the primary purpose of the hot shutdown panel is for fire in the control room.
Right.
That's the design basis for it. So it's not really the design basis for a loss of coolant accident. So it's not a self-contained environment that can be cleaned up. It is a place we could go, and that's why I hesitated on that response for leaving the control room. I'd rather stay in the control room, don my scuba, eat potassium iodide, and I can do a lot better. I can do a lot more things from the control room and better protect the health and safety of the public from there than anyplace else.
So to follow up on that, in the event of a loss of coolant accident, let's say, how would the operators know, or any other accident, how would they know to not go to the alternate shutdown panel?
That's a good question at this point.
Yes. Once we, thank the speaker, yeah, we will entertain public comments. Thank you, Mr. Ray, for a very informative presentation.
You're welcome.
Nice work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now let us entertain public comments on Mr. Wright's presentation. Please come to the podium.
I'll leave the slide. Move back to the slide.
I'll give you the right presentation.
It was slide number 2.
Would you please identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Liz Affelberg from the Mothers for Peace. No, the second diagram, where you had mode 2. Yes. All right. In this case, none of the air goes to the outside. All of it goes to the outside. All right. Then I was reading it. Then is there one of the modes where none of the air goes to the outside, where it all goes through the HEPA charcoal filter?
Yes, mode 3.
All right, mode 3 then, please. Where does the... if none of the air is going to the outside, but you still have more good air coming in, my question was, how much air can be held in the... held after it goes through the charcoal filter and doesn't go out?
Mike, if you want to answer that, you have to stand up and
Or does it slip to go to a different subtrain?
Well, maybe I can answer that for him. In this mode, there's nothing going in or out. It's all inside.
Okay.
None's going out, none's going in. It's all recirculated in this mode.
Right. And then under pressurization, there's leakage out of the control room because it's pressurized compared to the outside. But in this case, there's no outward flow or inward flow.
This is all entirely circulation.
Okay.
Okay. Does that help?
Thank you for your comment.
We're better off answering.
I'm Sherry Lewis, San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. My question I have is about the unrealistic doses that Dr. Budnitz was mentioning. That always raises a red flag to me when the doses are changed, saying, oh, gee, what we thought was bad really turns out not to be so bad. When somebody suggests, or engineers or whatever, suggests that a certain dose is considered not a good dose, you got to stay below that. What was that original assessment based on so that you can say later, oh, well, we were wrong, that dose really wasn't that bad, you can make it a little higher? And the reason I say this is my understanding is that in Fukushima they had regulations about how hot the fish had to be in order to, how radioactive the fish had to be in order to be.
The engineering community really understood how these accidents progress. These accidents meaning the large accidents that cause loss of cooling and damage to the core and evolution of fission products. And not understanding how those accidents progressed, the agency at the time, this is the regulatory agency at the time, made assumptions based on their best engineering judgment about what those, how those accidents might progress, and they called that the source term. Okay? The source term is the source, what the source of radioactivity is as it emerges from one of these large core metal accidents. Yeah, it's the phrase for how much radioactivity is going to emerge as the core melts, like what happened at Fukushima or actually what happened at Three Mile Island. And then not knowing quite how it was going to progress, the agency at the time, this is going all the way back to the 70s, raised that number by a factor, like a multiple, like two or three times as much, and said, assume that for the purposes of designing your control and ventilation system, okay? Then in the 80s, a huge experimental program was undertaken both in the U.S. and overseas, in Japan and in Europe and here, to understand how those accidents progressed. And the result of that was we came to understand that less radioactivity was actually emerging from the core during these core melt accidents than they thought in the 70s. And that's now based on experiments and is more realistic than the earlier assumptions which weren't based on experiments. We call that second thing a more realistic source term, or in the jargon of the people that deal with this, an alternate source term, but it's actually just simply more realistic. And we now believe that that more realistic source term is a more accurate reflection of how these accidents progress than the things they thought before, which weren't based on experiment. And now we've actually had a real experiment in Japan. It's not an experiment, it's experience, in which the understanding from the experiments that were done in the 80s was validated in Japan by the radioactive occurrences that happened at Fukushima. So that actually has validated our understanding, and we have a much better understanding. So, of course, it wasn't changing the dose limits for the operators. It was changing the amount of radioactivity to which they would be exposed during an accident based on more realistic understanding. Okay, it's a very different situation than what you described. Okay?
I must say, you know, I, for one, appreciate Ms. Lewis' healthy skepticism. Whenever people change things around in this industry, your healthy skepticism really serves to advance the safety review of this particular facility. Right? What Dr. Bundes said is certainly true. However, I do read between the lines about your concern. You know, for these specifically designated accidents, there's no dispute vis-a-vis what Dr. Burton has just indicated. However, are we covering all the bases? You know, are these specifically designated?
Served in leadership roles both within Diablo Canyon and out in our electric operations organization. And so he's been in maintenance, like I said, electrical operations, and here in performance improvement.
Thank you, Kerry. Gentlemen, good afternoon.
Welcome.
So we're here to talk about human performance today and give you an overview of some of the activities that are going on at the plant and activities that we've taken recently to make human performance improvement even better. So a little bit of the agenda. What I thought we would do is talk a brief review of what is human performance for the benefit of everyone in the room, really describe what it is and what we talk about when we mean that, discuss the current status of events and performance of the plant, and actions that have been recently completed and actions that are in process at this point in time to continue to improve the state of human performance. On the screen, you'll see that blue icon, and I want to point that out. That's a recent addition to some of the work we're doing to bring human performance more into the forefront, a little bit of marketing so that we can put icons and messages and procedures and signage along the road. Perhaps on your trip out there today, you notice the signs. Advertising and invoking some requirements around human performance. The more we feel we can put that in front of the plant personnel, make them aware of it, some of the requirements, the more habit they're going to make this particular work. So a long time ago, Aristotle said, we are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. And that's really one of our goals, is to make human performance excellence a habit and not something you just act on. So if we can ingrain it in the human behavior so that they use those tools every day in the work they do, the likelihood of a mistake or error is greatly reduced. So an overview of human performance. We're all human. Human error is normal. We do make mistakes. One of our goals is to provide defense in depth through various barriers and training, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, to minimize the impact of an event when it occurs, to minimize the likelihood that an individual makes a mistake in the first place. And that requires, as that last note indicates, a very sound strategy around how you're going to perform with respect to human performance. And you see some of the icons at the bottom. The self-checking or star is an icon to help the employee remember to stop and verify that what he's about to do is the right thing and that the plan or configuration or process is ready for him to make that move. And also verify that what he receives from the task that he performs is an expected response. Procedure use and adherence is exactly what it says. Am I following my procedures, my processes, my written documentation effectively and correctly? And if I'm not sure about what I'm doing, should I stop? And we encourage our employees to stop and verify that things are correct before they move forward. So human performance, as we define it, is really a combination of the individual's behavior and the results of those behavior. And combined together, they result in human performance as we measure it. Behavior is kind of nice because it's observable, it can be measured, and through training, it can be changed. And by making sure that you drive the behavior that you're looking for, you ultimately drive the results or the outcomes of that behavior. And ideally, we drive the number of errors and events down through that and result in an error-free performance, which is our desired end result. This illustration gives you an oversight of some of the barriers. If you have holes in those barriers, events can develop and occur. If all those holes happen to line up such that there's now holes in the processes all the way through, down to the final act performed by the employee, you can have an event. So one of our goals is to ensure those holes and those barriers are mitigated or eliminated, and that finally, that final individual who performs the task, that's your last barrier of defense. So if we can make that individual as intelligent and smart in using those tools as we can, the likelihood of an event is highly reduced. So human performance monitoring, how do we track that? How do we keep track of what's going on at the plant? We have an observation and coaching program. This is where our leaders are encouraged to go out and observe, not only in the training environment, but in the actual work environment, the performance of the employees. Are they performing the task as we expected? Are they using the human performance tools as we've taught them to use them? If not, we can coach them on the spot, get them back on track, back on focus for using those tools effectively. Operating experience and lessons learned. Mike talked about this earlier. Very valuable tool. By being able to learn from everything that goes on within the industry and acting on that quickly, we can make rapid changes at our site to maybe learn from an event that occurs at another location. Like Mike mentioned, we have operating experience mailed out every single day to the plant staff, and they're expected to review it, supervisor scan it, see if there's something that applies to his group. Human performance is such a wide, pervasive topic that typically you can extract some human performance element from any OE and then roll it into the work that you do. Event trending. So we watch all the station department-level events and minor low-level events to see what's happening. Look for behavior trends, department trends, anything that might give us a clue on an area we want to go improve. So we watch for that and then make improvements. Self-assessments and benchmarking. Those are areas where we self-assess. We'll perform formal and informal self-assessments of our group. How are we performing with respect to human performance? We just completed a self-assessment on the recent outage, 2R17, looked at how the plant did as a site with respect to human performance, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Procedures and training are another way to make sure that we monitor that. All of the procedures have embedded human performance elements in them to help the employee stay on track with the work that he's doing. Training also has human performance elements embedded from the very first class that an employee takes as a new employee through advanced technical training, either in operations, maintenance, or engineering. There's HULMs or human performance elements in that training to try to, again, make it a habit to use those tools. And finally, the corrective action process is a way to document and capture anything that doesn't function as we expect it to, a behavior, piece of equipment, that allows us to track and then ultimately fix that problem. So the benefits of human performance, really, when we're very good at it, it's a win-win for everybody. If you can prevent events and mistakes from occurring, you have employee safety is number one. We want to make sure that the employees don't get hurt. The event prevents that from occurring. Nuclear safety, again, if we don't have an issue or incident to deal with, the integrity and nuclear safety of the plant remains very high. Plant reliability is an obvious offshoot of that, and it continues to remain high as well, which results in operational efficiency. So the entire plant and process and staff operates in a much more efficient mode than if we didn't have mistakes and errors, if we did, rather. So how are we doing? So performance at the station is improving. The average person goes to work every day with the intention of doing a very good job and making sure that they do that job error-free. What we want to do is manage the situations that put that individual in a position where he's maybe more likely to make a mistake. So some of the tools, again, the icons on the bottom of the screen is let's stop and check. Peer checking, that third icon, is a very valuable tool. It's where if you're not sure, get a peer check. And in some cases, we require a peer check based on the procedure or document that they happen to be using. And a person can only do his job as good as the organization supports him, which is what I'm hoping to show you is some of these icons and training and operating experience, lessons learned, are all built around providing an organization that can support that employee and a job well done without mistake.
You want to explain STAR to the public?
STAR, our self-checking? Great, yeah, I'll do that.
First S in STAR is stop. Go ahead.
Stop. Stop, think, explain. Act, review.
Stop,
is the STAR.
Think. Stop, think. People can do that at home. It really, if, that's the sort of thing that we can do at home.
Correct.
Right? I'm going to say it again for them.
So stop, think, act, review. So stop before you do the task. Make sure that what you're about to do is correct and your documents and procedures are instructing you to do just that. Think about what you're about to do and ensure that you are ready to go. Act is the actual act of performing the task, such as operating a switch. So an operator may change the position of a switch in the control room. And then review is, did I get what I expected from that response? Did the equipment do what it was supposed to do? Am I seeing indications that I think I'm going to see following that response? If not, you again stop, and then you try to determine what's wrong. But the self-checking part of that is, am I ready to do what I should be doing? Is the system ready to receive what I'm about to do?
Explain the last one, no touch.
Last icon, no touch, says robust barrier. We have a process at the plant where we have robust barriers, and we'll put physical barriers over devices we do not want to be touched or manipulated during certain conditions of the plant. And then technicians may say they go up to work on a panel and they have very similar equipment or switches side by side, and they're going to work on switch for 8,000 alpha and the switch for 8,000 bravos right next to it. And if we do not want to touch the 8,000 alpha switch, we will cover it with what we call a robust barrier. So before the work starts. That way, during the execution of the work, the technician individual is less likely to touch that that has a barrier on it. Good question.
And Mr. Franheim, would you please elaborate a little bit more on the third bullet?
So peer checking.
Your third bullet.
Well, third bullet, situations where errors can occur are predictable, manageable, and preventable. So it's you're able to generally predict a situation. For example, if an employee is fatigued or tired, if an employee is busy or feels schedule pressure, or maybe they get to a situation in the plant where it's not exactly as they expect it to be, those are the type of situations that are predictable. And by manageable, it means if you recognize that situation before you take any action, then you can stop and put yourself in a position of making sure you don't have a mistake. So we encourage the individuals at that point, stop what you're doing right there, go talk with your supervisor, perhaps go talk with the control room, try to understand the situation before you move forward in the work that you're asked to do to make sure that everything that get out there with their work documentation and say the work is to do work on panel Bravo, but panel alpha is right next to it, then they would agree, we're not working on panel alpha, we'll put a barrier over panel alpha and peer check themselves to make sure they have the barrier over the correct panel, and then they're ready to go with their work. The second check is now they still have to walk through their work process. and that's where they can use STAR. Okay, we are working on Panel Bravo, and if my step one is to, you know, identify Panel Bravo, now they're going to identify Panel Bravo. So now actually they've gone through four processes of making sure they're on the right component before they've even touched any equipment.
Great. May I please ask public members not to ask questions at this time, because without the microphone at the podium, the transcriber would not be able to pick up what your questions are.
And the people watching at home.
Right. So please wait until Mr. Freinheim is done. Thank you.
So some of the actions we've taken to improve performance in the past few months. We developed recently a human performance overall strategic plan. And for the last decade and a half, we've had a human performance program. And what we realized, and the industry's realized, is we needed to take a step back and develop a more overarching, higher-level strategic plan. Where do we want to be in the future? What actions and processes, procedures do we want to put in place? And to learn from each other as an industry. So we now have that overarching strategic plan in place. We performed a self-assessment on our outage performance with respect to human performance, and we've completed that. We designed and implemented some new icons, which you saw on the road out to the plant this morning and you've seen on the slides today. And those are making their way into various procedures and training elements just to be more visible to the employee as another way to mentally engage on that tool. Recently, we revised the emerging issue process. And this was just prior to the outage, to try to make sure that when an event occurred, even at a low level, it was, one, had a team assigned to it quickly, that we could do a quick causal analysis to determine what happened. But the benefit we've really seen out of this is rapid communication of the plant staff. One of the elements of this new process is that we communicate that same shift, one, that something did occur, and then when the initial analysis is done and we understand what happened, we communicate the final results of that event. And so the plant received a lot of communication this past outage, as we communicated much more than we ever have before. We think that played a significant role in driving our event rate down. We received a lot of comment from the plant that, you know, I never knew that we'd had these many events. We actually had fewer events this outage than before, but we communicated them much better. And staff were saying, I learned from that. I'm not doing that myself because I don't want to have that same mistake happen to me. And what we ended up with was one of the best outage performances with respect to human performance ever recorded at the facility. We also hosted an industry human performance conference late fall last year. This was an international conference attended by Japan, China, the UK, and as well as most of the utilities in the United States. There's a photo on the next slide that illustrates one of the demonstrations we performed with respect to procedure use and adherence. Dynamic learning activities are a new tool that we're using more than ever before. And in this particular demonstration, we have one of the subcontractors working for PG&E. We train our supplemental personnel and our contractors to the same standards that our employees are expected to follow. And this is one of our contractors demonstrating how to use proper procedure use and adherence during a dynamic learning activity for the outage. As we learned of events during the outage, we went ahead and called stand-down meetings with leadership to share that information with them, asked them to take that back to their team. We're learning as we go, and if we can learn quicker, we can be more leading in the way we train. We instituted a high-performance, high-impact team that met daily. We reviewed all incidents and information that came in within a 24-hour window, summarized it, communicated it to leadership, and then used that to get better. One of the results was it was the lowest ever recorded events for us at the station. Here's an example of a poster we put up. It also demonstrates the use of STAR, so this might help the public. Here's an individual operator. He's got a procedure in his hand. He's walked up to the piece of equipment. He has taken a look at his procedure, putting his finger on the label, verifying that it matches what he's expected to do. And he can self-check at this point and use STAR to walk through before he performs any physical work at all. Am I on the right place, right time, right piece of equipment? And if he has a peer with him, peer could be looking over his shoulder, confirming, yes, we are on the right piece of equipment. Few additional actions we've taken that are in process, rather. So we're in the course of revising the human error investigation process. We had a tool called the HITE, Human Error Investigation Tool, that we currently use at the site. We felt that didn't dig deep enough into the behavior that caused an event when an event did occur. So we're going to revise that process using a model that was developed in the UK with a slight twist here that's going to be a human factors analysis-based process. The intent there is to truly separate any organizational drivers from the behavior drivers of the individual and focus on those two so we can go ahead and tackle those two issues and drivers separately. So that's in the process of being developed and will be rolled out in the next month. We've developed and presented a lesson plan, or rather developing, we're about to present a lesson plan to all of leadership, supervisors up, that's going to pull everyone back onto the same page with respect to what are the standards for human performance and how do you effectively coach in the field when you see a deviation from those standards. That training starts another week or two and will continue through the end of July. We're also involving the plant. We want to get feedback from the plant at the level of the individual contributor through the use of focus groups. So what do you guys think? What's causing some of the issues? How can we help you be successful employees, do your work on a daily basis without mistake? Affective training is another new technique, incorporating affective training methods. That's how do you pull the emotional element into training? How do you sink into the person's head that I really want to do this because I don't want to get hurt. I don't want to make a mistake. And that's a new technique that the industry is looking at to try to inculcate human performance behaviors into everybody's daily work practice. And lastly, revising the human performance procedure to incorporate all of the things we just talked about. So we'll be working on the underlying procedural elements, make sure that's now in written form that everyone can refer to. So in summary, we did a quick review of what is human performance. It's the individual's behavior, and those results combined give you the human performance of the individual or the team. Continued focus is important. We've completed actions that we have documented to be helpful. We think this a continued full court press we currently have on HU is going to make a big difference in making those sustainable. Performance is continuing to improve, which we're very glad to see. And there's a lot more actions in place, as we just discussed. Thank you.
Comments?
I said, you know, if you were working at a nuclear power plant, the probability of that was not zero, but it would have been reduced a good deal. And she says, why? I says, because of a nuclear power plant, you'd have a checklist. By the way, you know, she's been baking cakes all life. She didn't have a checklist. You put in this, you put in the oven, right? But without a list that you check off. Well, one of the things, and I think this is something you're going to reiterate, you're going to nod at. One of the things that happened in nuclear power plants is people that have been maintaining a certain piece of equipment for a decade or two often will say, leave me alone, I know how to do that. Right? You know, I've been maintaining this diesel generator for 20 years. I don't need this checklist stuff. But in fact, what we've learned and what you're reflecting here is the industry has learned that even all the more for people that are repetitive, the probability that you're going to leave something, like my wife left out this ingredient, and I'm not making fun of her, I love her, the probability of that is some small probability, but it's not zero. And you can't make it zero with a checklist either, but you can reduce it a good deal. And I think that's sort of the lesson for members of the public, that although all this stuff can't make things zero, every one of these things has a role in reducing the sort of thing that you get into habit and you leave something out. It's just one of those things that happen. And then the answer to the question, well, but does it really work, is for sure it works. We know it works because you have evidence of before and after. I think you can speak to that evidence yourself, but it's not just you. It's all around the industry.
That's right.
Many people think these checklists and these peer reviews and all that stuff is a burden. Well, you know what? It is a burden. But the burden is far less negative than the negative of having the thing go wrong.
Right? It's not unusual for a new employee to say, these are just slowing me down. I really want to do my job.
You bet it's slowing you down.
That's exactly right. We want it to slow you down so that you don't make a mistake.
Yeah, I bet if I tried to get my wife next time to have a checklist on the cake, she'd throw me out. You know? Of course, the consequences aren't. It's not the point of the consequences. The point of the story is that we all recognize that people make mistakes like that from, you know, every so often. It's pretty rare. But the job of the industry, and, of course, here we are checking it ourselves, is to try to see how we can together think of ways to reduce those things as much as we can.
Right.
Let us hope Mrs. Butness doesn't watch the committee's video right now.
No. If she's watching, I'll send her and tell her. It's okay. She loves me too. And it's a true story. So, you know, I didn't say anything wasn't true. It's just one of those things that we've all understand happen.
Let me know how that checklist works for you.
Yeah, well, there's no way on earth she's going to do that. But at a nuclear plant, those slowing down burdens tend to pay for themselves over and over. Right?
Yes, they do.
Additional comments from the bench? Absent none. Thank you, Mr. Frenheim. And then now we will welcome public comments on Mr. Frenheim's presentation. So please come to the podium and identify yourself so your remark will be summarized in a minute.
I have to mention this. Before I start the engine on my boat, I have to do the checklist.
Oh, for our record, would you please identify yourself?
Henrietta Groot. And as a psychologist, I'm...
People say they're actually afraid sometimes to get into it because it's such a technical arena. But for the most part, everyone I've talked to says we really like the process, the procedure, the training you give us so that I don't make a mistake. I use these tools. And it's not unusual to hear them say a few months or weeks later, you know what, I'm using these tools at home. I'm checking my weed trimmer before they work. I'm putting on my safety glasses, something they never did before.
Is that right?
So it's very much appreciated in general.
So that's good. In other words, they're internalizing it into the rest of their life.
Yes, which is the habit part we would love them to get into.
That's very encouraging.
Good. Just leave and have an hour.
Yeah, no, wait.
Tell her to identify herself.
Yeah, I have a question. I'm Sherry Danoff, and I'm an area resident. There's been discussion about whether licensing, PG&E licensing, would allow accelerated transfer of rods from the pools to dry casts. And I'm wondering if there will be some reporting on that in the future, on whether current licensing allows acceleration of removal of the rods from pools to dry casts.
I think we can probably answer that directly, that it allows it. Yes, it does.
Oh, okay.
There's nothing in the license that prohibits it.
I didn't. I had thought that that
anybody,
was a question.
Anybody want to contradict what I just said? I mean, I think that's...
I think that a couple of key points would be then what happens in the pools themselves. The current racking system would still be the high-density racking system, even if you were to accelerate the removal of the – take more fuel out. The current – one of the things that's happened in terms of the practice for the fuel shuffling is that they now have rules – actually, they've had them for some time – that require that any freshly offloaded fuel assembly be placed in a position where it's surrounded by older and colder fuel. And this is important. I think it's not commonly known how much larger the heat generation rate is shortly after fuel is discharged compared to after a few months to a couple of years of cooling. But one interesting statistic is that when you offload a full core into a spent fuel pool, the total amount of heat being deposited into the water more than doubles. That is, that one core can have more heat generation than 20 or 30 years worth of previous spent fuel does that's been sitting in the pool. And so the largest concerns associated with losing water inventory and overheating fuel are associated with those hotter fuel assemblies that have a lot of heat generation, and the flow paths for air to get into those assemblies are quite restricted with the high-density racking, which is why a freshly offloaded assembly is at significant risk of experiencing damage and even potentially heating up neighboring older fuel assemblies enough that they could experience damage too. So these are the issues associated with the high-density racking. But it would certainly require a license amendment to change back to
tasks, which would mean more heat. And eventually we would get to a point where, you know, we
couldn't
do it. So that is the one licensing thing that I'm aware of that would impact taking, you know, would prevent us from taking all the fuel and putting it up on the
right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments.
Jane Swanson, San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. I have quite a list. I think maybe six items. So I know the drill. I'll just do them and go sit down.
Something in your name was read before, as we started the afternoon session.
Yes. Right. I'm not going to repeat that.
Yeah, okay.
No, I know that was presented. I'm dealing with what I've heard since I got here at 2:05. Somebody asked if there was resistance from new employees to the checklist system, and my question is, I'd love to hear about the attitude of the old employees. I'm old myself, so that's not a pejorative term, but those who have been employed at Diablo for decades and were not required to do those strict test lists. I'm imagining some of them might resist it, and if they did, I'm very interested in knowing what is the consequence for anybody who works at Diablo who fraudulently checks off that list. I mean, Mothers for Peace gets phone calls from people who work out there, and not recently, I will say, but years ago, we got lots of phone calls from people who stayed anonymous saying they were upset because their supervisor was just checking off a list or just saying the weld had been inspected when it had not been, and then another worker would witness this and be upset because that person had very high standards and was upset at seeing procedures not properly followed. So that's what leads me to ask, what is the consequence should an employee be caught not following the excellent plan? I like that checklist plan.
You did say just now that those contacts to your organization have decreased.
They have decreased.
Yeah.
They have. I'd say
thank God.
They have tapered off in the last 4 years.
Okay.
I would say that. That is not a scientific sampling
of
what goes on, by the way. I'm not claiming that.
But it's an observation.
Yes, and isn't that nice of me? I look for positives to say to this group. And then there was a reference by the gentleman whose name I forgot already, the last presenter, saying that I heard him say that contractors were given the same training as PG&E employees. That was a great thing for me to hear. And in the context in which he said it, I wasn't sure if that was like across the board or just in certain segments of this new human performance procedure. So if maybe he could elaborate on that a little bit. And I've really... the last few comments on the different factors involved in moving spent fuel into dry cask on an accelerated rate, perhaps, or not. That was extremely interesting. I learned a lot from that. And the subject has been raised at these meetings, so I will be hoping that on future meetings we'll learn more about this. I'd love a little PowerPoint that shows more about what that story, that if you uncover the top foot and a half, you're almost guaranteed a fire which would disperse radiation into the atmosphere, and that I learned from Gordon Thompson, expert witness for San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. So I'm quoting an expert on that one, and so I feel very confident about saying that. So I look forward to seeing more about that at a future meeting. I'll hope for it. Thank you.
Thank you for your remark, Ms. Swanson.
Dr. Lam, I can answer the questions around human performance if you so desire.
Do we want to make sure we have all the questions?
Right. Do we have additional public comments at this time? If not, Mr. Kerry Harbour would like to respond.
Wait, I just want to with a response on one of the things you said. I think you made an excellent suggestion about the possibility of our having a presentation with more of that specific information, and we'll take that under advisement and see what we can do.
Yes.
I think that communicating that it would be very valuable.
Yes, indeed. Mr. Harbour?
Okay, Ms. Swanson, I want to thank you for your questions. They're very, very good questions and very real in terms of the type of things that we address at the plant. So the first question you had is about employees that are more experienced. And so suddenly as we increase use of human performance tools, you know, they're not used to, you know, weren't used to doing it. But that was really kind of, I would say, I'm going to say, as Mark mentioned, 10 years ago as we really start to ramp these up. So what we did experience is some level of resistance, as you would expect. If Dr. Budness suddenly instructed his wife to use a checklist.
I just said she'd throw me out.
After she threw him out for instructing her, which my wife would do the same. But then should they decide to go ahead and do that, there would be all the challenges around first getting used to it, right? So that's the natural human part of it, to get used to doing it. And then, of course, there would be moving it into a mode where it becomes more habit, where the individual begins to see the results of using it. And so that takes time in terms of changing the culture. And there's techniques that we use and the industry uses to help that along. We use, of course, as Mark mentioned, peer, that we would pair up with folks to basically ensure that that it was done. And then we'd have observations. And then we'd incorporate it also into our training programs so that when the task is performed, if those tools aren't used, then the training requirements are not met. So we use all of those things to be able to help to take it from an action to be performed to something that becomes more habit. And so we just continue to reinforce that with our staff, and then we track the results. As Mark mentioned, we track the errors at a very low level so we can see if we're getting the results that we expect. But that's a great question, and it is. It's definitely something that the industry has been working through, and we're seeing a lot of results as a result of that. The next question you had was around what would happen to someone if they fraudulently just falsified a document. And what I would say to there is that is not something that's acceptable at PG&E, at any nuclear facility, by any of the companies that operate nuclear facilities, and by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So they also have rules against that, and action can be taken against someone that does that. And that action would go even beyond Pacific Gas and Electric. It would actually... That is universal. We look at the whole staff because everyone affects the operation of our nuclear plant. We, regardless if they're a PG&E person or someone who's coming in to assist us with activities, basically to get the same level of training, the same level of oversight, so that we can minimize errors in all levels of the operation.
Great. Thank you. Now I think we are coming to the final agenda of this public meeting, which would be... Oh, hi. Yeah, this is, may I recognize Mr. Ken Oliver? I used to be the committee's liaison between the committee and PG&E. Welcome back. This is the final agenda would be for committee members. Concluding remarks, Dr. Peterson and Dr. Butness. Concluding remarks, please. With no concluding remark. Oh, Dr. Butness.
Yeah, I had an observation, which I think is worth repeating. We heard it earlier yesterday. They had an outage just 2 months ago in which basically every indicator in the outage of safety and of performance was tops. And those of you that saw this, either you're watching streaming or that were here, and certainly we did, saw it. And that's really remarkable. There was less radiation dose to the employees than was predicted, and you always try to make a prediction, and less than in any other outage in the history of the plant. There were zero, you can't get better than zero, injuries, okay, accidents. You know, that's just, it's great. There's always something, often several. And every other indicator was great. Now, you know, just to be candid, you can't expect it's going to be zero every time for the next 25 years, but it's, to us, a sign that... something's going in the right direction compared to, let's say, a few years ago, and I just want to report that I at least, and I bet the others are going to say the same, I at least am very pleased to see that a whole lot of stuff's been going on for a bunch of years, including this human performance stuff, has led to a remarkably successful outage. And by the way, it took less time and cost less money. By the way, they always have money for contingencies of things that go wrong, and there wasn't much that went wrong, so they didn't have to use it. So they came in with less cost and less time. And that's great. That's just an unusually good symbol that this plant is striving to do the best they can. Of course, you know, there are always things to look at, even in the best outage, and some of them were called attention to yesterday, and we're going to be looking at them too, because... even in that very best outage that they've ever had, there's still some lessons for the next one that we're going to be, that the plant is trying to assimilate and we're going to be reviewing. Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Bennis. Before this public meeting, Sir Jan?
I thought we should mention that our next public meeting will be on October 9th and 10th.
Yes, indeed.
Here as well, and we'll also be doing a public tour in conjunction with that public meeting.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Mr. Wellington. So before this public meeting is adjourned, let me take this opportunity to express the committee's appreciation to the members of the public who have been participating in our public meeting. Your participation is a critical, important tape record our proceedings. Thank you, everybody, and have a good evening. And this public meeting is now adjourned.